Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello, welcome everybody. You are listening to Mushing Radio here on KBRF 89.5 in the Mattsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and you can find all of our episodes over on iTunes. Search for Dog Works Radio and do us a favor and leave us a review and even subscribe if you like, and you'll get those episodes right on your iPhone. You can also find us over on dogworksradio.com as well as on Facebook and Twitter. And you can find me on Twitter at Robert Forto and my co-host who's calling in from Southern California. His name is Alex Stein, and you can follow him on Twitter at Coldfoot Films. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. It's starting to feel more and more like summer as it gets warmer and warmer. I know it's not officially summer yet. We've got a few more, I guess about another week before that. But lots of things happening and just feeling like it's very far from the middle of winter and the middle of dog mushing season.
You know, it is. It is an absolutely beautiful day. Last couple of weeks have been great up here in Willow, Alaska. And, you know, we're at the height of the summer season here. The tourists are back. All of the little tourist shops and haunts are full of tour buses and people wearing khakis with big cameras around their necks and winter coats on in June. It's so interesting to live up here in the Great White North in the middle of summer.
Yeah, and you know, I have some friends who do various things all over Alaska that are oriented towards tourists, and they love to post you know, the silly things that people ask about Alaska, you know, such as, I thought you all lived in igloos, you know, and people not understanding that it's not actually 20 degrees below zero 12 months a year. So but I would love to encourage any of our listeners who are living outside of Alaska, who have not been up to Alaska, to go. As you know, we talk about this from time to time, but it is an absolutely breathtakingly beautiful state, and that's true in the winter, and it's a different kind of beautiful in the summer, and I think a lot more tourist friendly and a lot more friendly towards people who maybe don't want to risk frostbite, but they want to be somewhere where it's just gorgeous. And there's always, you know, there's a ton of light in the summer. So people can go out and do things and stay out late. And in some parts of the state, you have close to 24 hours of light during the summer. So lots and lots of wonderful stuff to do.
It is. And, you know, it's relatively cheap to fly up here. I fly down to Denver, which is a major hub for a lot of airlines, a couple of times a year. And I can usually get a ticket on Alaska Airlines for about $300, $350 round trip if you scope out the fares right. That's a relatively cheap ticket to fly up here. And I encourage anybody that does come, you know, I'm sure, you know, lots of people have the lifelong dream of getting on that cruise ship and, you know, sailing up here and getting on a tour bus. But I encourage everyone, I tell all of my family and friends, to fly up here into Anchorage and rent a car and do it on your own. You will not get lost. There are hundreds of miles of roads here. And unknown to a lot of folks, they're actually highways, aren't there, Alex? Actually, 4 to 6 lane highways outside of the major metro areas, isn't there?
Yes, there are, and you can get your biggest problems in the summer, at least as far as driving goes, isn't that the highways aren't acceptable, but there's a lot of traffic, and because of the seasons, the highway department does a lot of road repair during the summer, so you're more likely to find a lot of construction, but I would not let that stand in your way.
Right. And, you know, since we are talking about off-season stuff and what happens up here in Alaska, not only to mushing, but to Alaska in general on this episode, was your favorite thing to do when you came up in the summer, Alex, besides all the mushing stuff? What was some place you've always been or something you were just dying to do when you came up here in the summertime for the first time?
Well, what people may not know is the first time that I came to Alaska was actually when my wife and I got married. And we went up on the Dalton Highway, which is the haul road that goes up to Prudhoe Bay. And I loved being up, you know, past Fairbanks when there just wasn't a lot of stuff to do. I loved that. I absolutely loved going deep into Denali National Park. You know, there's a bunch of places that are not exactly completely off the beaten path, but are places that maybe tourists don't go to as much. Homer is a wonderful and lovely town. Seward is just absolutely fantastic during the summers. And, you know, pretty much anywhere you go, you'll have a pretty good chance of seeing some wildlife. So I could not more highly recommend people taking a trip up to Alaska.
And for folks that are coming down from your way, what is the flight time to come up here? Is it 7-8 hours or so from L.A.?
Yeah, most of the year, there might be direct flights in the summer, I'm not sure, but most of the year you have to fly either through Portland or Seattle, and it's about it's about 3 hours from here to Seattle, and then I think it's another 3.5 hours from Seattle up to Anchorage. So if you flew direct, it might be a little bit less, but you're talking about 6.5 or 7 hours of flying time.
Right. All right, so let's jump into today's episode. We're talking about off-season prep, off-season chores, what mushers do when there is no snow on the ground. I think a very important thing that happens here, I guess it's 2 weeks from this coming Saturday, is the Iditarod Volunteer Picnic, and it is also the first chance for the mushers to sign up for the Iditarod for 2017. Now, there is a key reason why a lot of mushers sign up that day. Number one is they are one of the first to sign up, but number two is they draw for, I believe it's two, correct me if I'm wrong, Alex, free entries. So you'll get your fee back if they draw your name at the picnic, if you sign up. And that's key because this year, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of these rule changes here in just a few minutes, but they raised the entry fee by $1,000 this year. So it is now a $4,000 entry to enter the 2017 Iditarod. So I think it would behoove a lot of folks to sign up for the Iditarod at the picnic. Anybody can go to the picnic. It is open to the public, but it's to celebrate the volunteers. They also do the teacher workshops right around that time. I know my neighbor, Vern Halter, does a lot of that stuff right up the road here at his place, and a lot of the teachers get together and they do what they do. Teachers are a very important part of Iditarod. And, of course, there's lots of FaceTime, autographs, pictures and things with all the mushers that are at the picnic. and it's absolutely beautiful most times during the picnic in late June. Usually beautiful weather. We aren't usually rainy at that point. You do not need to wear a winter coat. You do not need to wear hats and gloves. You can come up here and enjoy yourself. It's probably going to be in the high 70s.
Right. And because in general, Iditarod mushers tend to be much more accessible, and it's much easier to get a chance to talk to them one-on-one than it would be to talk to someone in another major sport, you know, a football player, a football pro, or a basketball player. It's very hard to get to those people. It's relatively easy to get to mushers, and that's true at Iditarod time, but during the picnic, they don't have they don't have something immediate that's in front of them that they have to do. So they tend to be a little bit more relaxed. You can generally come up and have conversations with them, and most of the Iditarod mushers that I've ever met are very gracious and are, you know, very generous in terms of their time and in terms of signing things and talking to people and sharing stories. So this would be, if you are in Alaska or in or around Anchorage or I guess actually Wasilla, Kinnick, then you should definitely drop by. And it is, as you said,
right,
it's to honor the volunteers.
And that is, I believe, Saturday the 26th, so you can check it out on Iditarod.com. It's a very happening place. You know what's interesting during the picnic, Alex? I don't know if you have noticed this in the summer months, but sometimes these very popular mushers are a little bit difficult to recognize without all of their big, fat mushing gear on. Typically, you just see a small portion of their face, and sometimes they're difficult to recognize without all of that gear on, aren't they?
Yes, and you know, a lot of the mushers are known for wearing certain things. Didi Genro, for example, is known for always wearing that bright pink parka. So it's very easy to recognize. Might be a little bit more difficult to recognize because she'll presumably not be wearing that. But you know, Didi is a recognizable face, so I think people might not have a problem noticing her. Some of the other mushers maybe. But the other thing that I wanted to mention is, if you are a fan, if you're a real fan of mushing and of Iditarod, this is a great thing to do because not only can you talk to the top mushers, your Dallas Thieves and Jeff Kings and Mitch Thieves and, you know, Ali Zirkles and the people who are the top names and the top finishers, but you can also just go and talk to people who are back of the packers, people who have run a couple of Iditarods and maybe have placed in the middle, but aren't really ever going to be much of a threat to win the Iditarod. And these people generally put their heart and soul into this endeavor, and they don't get a lot of attention, and they are always, these people are always really, really eager to talk to fans.
Right. And mushers can sign up for the 2017 Iditarod up through, I believe it is December 1st. After that, there is a very significant late fee. I don't know exactly what that is each year. And then you can even sign up past then. And I've known a rookie or two that has done a qualifier in early January, like the Kinnick 200, which is the first weekend in January. And if they had to get in that last 200, they've done that and signed up for the Iditarod in the same year. Most rookies do not do that, but they are able. So therefore, mushers can sign up all through the summer and into the fall, into early winter, to sign up for the Iditarod. And, of course, as we progress through summer, fall training usually starts towards the end of August for most folks. But, you know, summer in a mushing kennel is all about chores. And, for example, today one of my mushers, Vanessa and I, tackled giving dog baths to 38 sled dogs. 5.5 hours, Alex, to bathe 38 sled dogs. And all of them were great. We typically do that a couple of times a year. But I know what a chore it is to most folks to give one dog a bath in their bathtub. Try doing that 38 times in a row.
So when you do that, do you have a special apparatus for that, or is it basically just kind of a garden hose, or how does that work?
Yep, we used a garden hose, and a good friend of mine is a commercial fisherman. His name is Dave Shear. He gave us a large fish hose a few years ago. It's about 4 foot by 4 foot square, from what to about your thigh or so, and we put all of them in there. It's a great big bathtub looking thing, and we just kind of hose them down and scrub them up with some good shampoo and get all that. That mud and funk and all that that they build up over the year off of them, and it's amazing what these little sud balls look like after a nice bath.
Wow. And I know a lot of people, especially people who have their own kennels, the summer is a time where you can, for example, make new dog boxes for the dog yard, paint the dog boxes, do some repairs like that, but also is this the time when you start looking at what your equipment needs are for the upcoming season, or does that happen later?
That happens right about now, and real quick, Alex, I want to apologize for some of that cluttering that's happening right before we went on air. They were giving us some notice about Skype was having some issues, so bear with us if you hear that cluttering when you're listening to the show. It's not on our part, it is the Skype network. We do look at equipment. Now it's a good time to not only buy equipment, but also sell equipment. There's all types of gear swaps happening at brushing clubs, and everybody's getting rid of the old stuff or getting out of brushing. I know we talked about that a couple of shows ago. A lot of folks will run Iditarod, and most of them up, and they will sell all of their gear and possibly sell all of their dogs, and usually now is the time that they do that so they can recoup some of their expenses and move on to their next endeavor. You mentioned building dog boxes. Yes, that's a very important thing that a lot of mushing kennels do. We are also in the process of replacing all of our dog houses. We do that about every 3 years or so. So we have 38 dog houses to build. We only have 8 done, and we're here towards the middle of June. Each of our dog houses is one piece of plywood and several 2x4s and a couple of 2x2s, and a coat of red paint, so they look like the Spooky houses. If you've seen some of our pictures on our website, sled dogs always like to sleep on top of their houses. So it looks like Spooky hanging out on the top of his house. In those pictures, that's where they prefer to be when it's nice and a beautiful day out. So yes, that is happening, as well as whatever other kennel maintenance chores have to happen, whether it be stringing fence or entertaining visitors and guests, giving cooler rides if it's not too hot. Our rule of thumb here, and it has been since we moved to Alaska, is we never run the dogs if it is above 50 degrees. So on the rare occasion that it is below 50 degrees, we're out there hooking up the dogs to the ATV and going on short runs just to stretch their legs. I believe the last time we did it was a couple of years ago on July 4th, on Independence Day. It just happened to be raining and really cool that morning. We ran out there in the rain, and I believe we were running dogs up until 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon as that weather held out.
I've also seen a lot of mushers that I follow online seem to be reporting within the last 2 or 3 weeks there are a lot of new litters coming in. Is there I'm sorry, this is probably a very stupid question, but is there a season when there tend to be more litters, or does it just happen all throughout the year?
You know, most of our dogs, and then I have no idea what's happening with others, but most of our dogs throw heat at about the same time. Typically, it's usually in the middle of mushing season, you know, January, early February, and then typically it's 6 months later. So it's right about now they will all go into heat again, you know, early May, beginning of June. And then dogs are pregnant for 63 days, and then you have a litter of puppies typically anytime between now and early fall. The problem with having puppies in the winter is those puppies have to stay in the house or a heated barn or kennel or whatever you have when they're very young, because obviously they cannot stay outside, you know, at 10 degrees below zero or whatever. And also, that mother is out of contention for any race. So for folks that are looking to have litters, it's definitely a very important task you have to keep on track of. We've all heard about the accidental litters on Iditarod and so on and so forth. But I would tend to believe that if you are wanting to have litters, it would be best to have them in the spring and early summer, so those pups are ready to, you know, to go outside and whatnot by early fall. Now, remember, they're not ready to run that first season. Typically, they're going to wait until the following year before they're in harness and running races or hardcore training. And, of course, they will do harness breaking and short runs and puppy runs and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I believe that summer would be the time to have pups if you want to do that.
Yeah. So last episode, we talked quite a bit about one of the new rules, the two-way communication rule. And shortly after we taped that show, they released the full text of the rule. And one of the things that we had talked about and that a lot of the mushers had been talking about was the idea of being able to use two-way communication devices, so cell phones, satellite phones, that sort of thing, to get outside coaching, to get additional information about what to do, when to take breaks, where other people were. When the Iditarod Trail Committee released the text of the rule, it specifically said that these devices were not to be used for coaching. A number of people have pointed out, though, that this is something that is going to be very, very difficult to enforce. We can certainly enforce the more flagrant violations of the rules, you know, such as people having teams of snow machiners up ahead calling in by satellite phone because you'd be able to see the snow machiners. But it's going to be very difficult to prevent people from getting information or getting some sort of tips or some sort of help that would count as coaching. It's going to be difficult to prevent them from getting that if the team has a cell phone or a satellite phone. And we've seen shortly after the rule was published, there was a petition circulated, started by Dallas Seavey and a couple of other people to repeal this rule. And I think we probably have similar feelings about this. I think that it is going to be so hard to stop people from doing that they should either repeal the rule or find a way to rework it so that it would be fairer. Having said that, I have to say that I very much admire Dallas Seavey for taking the lead on trying to get this rule changed, because as we've talked about, Dallas Seavey is probably one of the people who would be in the best position to benefit from a rule like this. And the fact that he is taking the lead to try to change this to make it more fair for other people, frankly, is very impressive and I think very admirable.
You know, I have a question to ask you about that, Alex. What do you think... The the outcome is to these types of petitions. You see them all the time circulated on the internet, in particular on Facebook and Twitter, where these folks will sign up for these petitions for whatever cause it is, whether it be mushing or any other thing in the news, whether it's petitioning, you know, President Obama to do one thing or the other. Do you think that they hold much water? I'm not a big fan of them. I don't go and sign very many of these because I don't think that they do much. What is your opinion of that?
I think in general, you are right. I think in general, they don't do very much. And the bigger the issue is that you're trying to tackle, the less likely a petition will make a difference. So for national political issues, you know, whatever national political issue you want to pick, I think that they are, you know, they are not very effective, and mostly make the people who sign them feel better about that they think they're doing something when they're not really doing a lot. In this case, I feel like it might have a better chance of having more of an effect, especially if a lot of the top mushers are signing it and are supporting it. And the only reason I say that is because Iditarod is so much smaller a community, and I'm not sure how many people there are on the Rules Committee, but I would imagine it can't be more than a dozen or maybe 20 people at most. So I think there's a much greater chance that if that small group of people can see that there is widespread support, especially among the mushing community and among the top mushers, then that might be able to have an effect on it.
Right. You know, another rule, I don't know if it was brought up at the Finishers Club meeting or, you know, with the Rules Committee. This past winter, a rule was broken by Ken Anderson. He was penalized for having more than two dogs abreast on the line. So I believe he had three dogs in lead or something like that, and he got a pretty significant time penalty, and not many people know about that. The Iditarod currently states that dog team can run only in tandem, meaning side by side or as single dogs, but they cannot run more than two abreast. And that harkens back way back into mushing history and still used today with many of the hunters that use dog sleds in, you know, Norway and Greenland, and, you know, in the extreme Arctic, they will use a fan hitch where they'll have all of the dogs attached at the sled, and then they'll sort of fan out away from the sled looking like a fan, and that's a very popular way to pull very heavy weight. But in the Iditarod, they cannot do that. They can only run side by side. So that is a rule that I believe is up for debate. I don't know if it's going to be ruled on this year, but I think that something needs to be clarified there, because we do it all the time here at our kennel, not necessarily in races, but in training, we'll put up a very young dog in between two very seasoned leaders, and we will put the younger dog or the dog that we're training for lead in the middle, so they can sort of get bounced around left and right, so they will learn the commands, they'll learn the positions, they'll learn how to keep the tug tight, so on and so forth, and it's a very good way for training. So I'm interested to see if that works out, and Alex, if you don't mind, we'll go over just a couple of minutes. Hopefully you're not in a parking lot or something trying to go to a meeting. Are you okay for a minute or two?
I am. I'm good.
Okay. The next one I want to talk about, we talked about just at the top of the show.
Before we move on, I just have a quick question. Is there, aside from being able to pull more weight, is there any kind of speed advantage to having more than two dogs?
I think it would tend to be slower. I mean, it's been a really long time since I've ran a fan hitch with my dogs. It's something that you have to train for to get the dogs to all, you know, because they're used to being side by side their whole lives. So I don't know if there's necessarily an advantage to it, but I don't know why the rule is in effect. I guess it's so they you know, that you can just have a cut and dry rule. You can have two dogs side by side or a single. So there isn't room for interpretation, I guess. But
yeah.
I don't see any real added benefit to having more than two up there other than training a young dog or, you know, something like that.
Because I know when this violation was pointed out and when Ken was penalized for it, a lot of people seemed surprised that this rule existed. It wasn't a rule that people were really aware of.
Right.
And it seems to me that if there's no advantage to doing this, that I'm not sure why there needs to be a rule against it.
Right. And you know that, and you know as well as I do, Alex, if there's not a rule, somebody will try to break it or you know, establish some type of foothold for why they should do one thing or the other. So I think it's mainly just to keep all the dogs, you know, in equal formation so that all the teams are the same, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Very similar to the sled rule. Must have a working brake, must have a brush bow, must have a sled bag, you know, so on and so forth. Must have, you know, runners and you know, all the a bridle so they can attach the dogs. Because if you don't have that, I'm sure you will find folks out there doing all sorts of things to either shave off points or not points, but weight or time or anything like that. So you have to have rules so they can't be broken, I guess. So, Alex, let's talk about this last rule or issue that has come up for debate. It is the new entry fee. As we talked about at the top, they raised the entry fee by $1,000. So it is now a $4,000 entry, which is a significant amount than it was last year. But they also raised the purse by $50,000. And we'll bring up Ken Anderson again. And he said on his Facebook page was, I'm not going to quote, but not necessarily verbatim, but he said pretty much, thanks a lot for raising the entry fee and allowing the front runners to earn more money by obviously if they raise the purse, the top mushers will get more money in order to, you know, in the place that they finish. What do you think about that, Alex? $4,000 is a lot of money. And remember that that doesn't include very much. That pretty much includes your entry fee, your support along the way, straw and heat for your cooker, and that's about it. You're paying for pretty much all of the weight for your drop bags. I believe it's a 500-pound they give you 500-pound credit, but most folks are sending anywhere from 1,500 to 2,000 pounds out on the trail, so 500 pounds isn't a heck of a lot to worry about. But what are your thoughts on this this new entry fee uprising, I guess?
You know, it seems like an enormous increase to me. And I don't have the figures in front of me, but someone said that that they had lowered the amount of weight that you were allowed or lowered the amount of weight that you got for free as part of your entry fee in addition to raising the entry fee. So
So
people are now going to have to pay for a larger percentage of their drop bag weight. So it's $1,000 for that, and then however much it is for the lower amount allowed. You know, we've talked a lot about the fact that it is not inexpensive to run Iditarod. It's a very costly endeavor. This is going to make that even more costly. I worry that it's going to force out some of the, you know, some of the less well-capitalized or less famous mushers. It's going to make it a lot harder for mushers who are working full-time jobs and trying to train, you know, at night and get some time off from their jobs to run. I think it's going to make it a little bit more expensive and maybe something that appeals more to people who already have a lot of money and just this is their bucket list, and they can afford to spend, you know, they can afford to just drop $50,000 or $60,000 or $70,000 to lease a team and to go and do their qualifiers and run Iditarod. It's I like the increased purse, but I think Ken is right that it's going to primarily go to the mushers who are already famous and the mushers who are already making the majority of the money. And for most folks, they're going to be getting their $1,049 for finishing.
Right. You know, I agree with you, and if we can just go full circle on this, I think with this increased entry fee that you may see less people signing up at the picnic in a couple of weeks. It's difficult to have planned on, you know, this coming race at $3,000 up until just about a month ago, you know, for folks that that do work just in the summer, which is a very quite a few mushers. They'll work in the summer months, whether they're fishermen or construction or whatever they're doing for their summer job, so they can, you know, run dogs in the winter. $1,000 is a lot of money. Yeah, you know, people are paid better up here in Alaska, but still, $1,000 is $1,000, and I think that's a very significant increase. And I don't quite sure know why they did that. You know, I've been scratching my head why Iditarod has done a lot of things this year, but this seems to be a real head scratcher for me. I know that the economy in Alaska has struggled as of late with the oil pulling out and whatnot, but you know, the Iditarod's a nonprofit, and they get a heck of a lot of donations. They have an excellent raffle where they raffle off two or three Dodge trucks every year. They do one at the fair, and they do one at the I believe they do one at the banquet, if I'm not mistaken. I know they do a couple of them a year, so they raise a lot of money that way. And there's still quite a few really big sponsors on board. You know, we could have a whole other show about Donlin Gold and you know, their part with Iditarod and you know, some of that. But there's still quite a few pretty big sponsors out there, aren't there?
Yeah. And I think that a lot of people are looking at the big name sponsors and looking at some of these, you know, for example, the gag rule, which seems partially designed to protect some of the sponsors. And people are wondering, well, if there are all of these sponsors, why does so much have to come from the mushers? And to be
right.
fair, it's a really expensive thing to run a race like Iditarod. It, you know, to move people and equipment and judges and everything up and down the trail requires planes, it requires fuel, it requires snow machines. There's all sorts of stuff that goes into it, most of which is not cheap. So I'm not begrudging them that. It seems like it's a huge increase to happen all at once. And you know, if you suddenly next month saw that your phone bill had gone up by a third, or your cable bill had gone up by a third, or the cost of milk or eggs had gone up by a third, that would be shocking to you. And
right.
I think that this kind of feels like that sort of thing, except for a lot of people who run Iditarod, they feel like, well, this is my life, and it's a very expensive thing to do, so this is just one more expense to add to the vet bills and to the equipment and to the dog food bills and all of that.
Right. You know, a couple of more points on that, Alex. You know, last year was sort of a fluke year with the number of mushers that was in the race in Iditarod. Typically, it's anywhere between, you know, 50 and 70 people signing up for Iditarod. And it's interesting because if they raise the purse by $50,000 and they raise the entry fee by $1,000. If they have an average year of number of buses, say 60 people, that's only $60,000 more in income for entries. So it looks like most of that is going to the purse for the top 5 or 10 mushers anyway. That's where I have the biggest problem. What do you think about that?
Yes, I am totally on the same page with you. I also noticed that this year, and I don't know if it's been the case in past years, maybe back 5 or 10 years, but it hasn't been the case in the past few years when I've been paying a lot of attention to it. But they in the rules this year, they capped the number of entries. So there's a strict cap, which I believe is 100. I could be wrong. It could be 110, but they capped it, the number of entries. And my first thought was, well, there have never been that many entries that it would really seriously push up against the cap. I think I think there were a couple of years where there were 90, but I don't think there's ever been a year where there were 100. And I would imagine that people who were struggling financially might decide, okay, I'm not going to do it, or I'm not going to do it this year. And a lot of mushers were talking publicly about, well, maybe I'll do the Yukon Quest instead of Iditarod. So I would think that the increased entry fee would cause the number of entrants to go down rather than up. But they seem to be building in this idea that this is going to be capped, and so you have to be one of the first 100 or you won't get in.
And another reason why folks sign up at that picnic, at least they are pretty much guaranteed a spot, because there's always 20 or 30 odd people that are signing up during those months between now and December. So you're pretty much guaranteed a spot if you get in at that picnic. So Alex, I know we're running over, and I want to make sure we get into our new feature here on the show. Recommendations. I know I had you go first last time. I didn't even ask you what yours were before airtime, but I only have one this week. Just a couple of weeks ago, I got a chance to finally see the Lance Mackey documentary, The Great Alone. It is now on Netflix, so just about anybody can watch it. You don't have to worry about buying it on Amazon or iTunes or anything like that. You can buy it right there stream it right there on Netflix. And I have to say, Alex, I didn't know much about the movie other than what I read on Facebook, in particular on Lance's page, but that is a documentary. Not only was the cinematography just rocking, especially on the aerial shots of Lance and his team, but all of the backstory that we learned, not only from Lance, but also his brother Jason and his dad Dick and his mother Kathy. I'm pretty good friends with his mom Kathy. We met several years ago and we became pretty good friends. I love seeing her on the documentary. And I don't know if you know this, Alex, but shortly after they finished wrap up on the filming of that, she was diagnosed with cancer. And battled it pretty good. I believe she's still cancer-free. She's currently living up, I believe, with Lance, or at least there near his property. And it was great to see Kathy and the whole family. And, boy, what an upbringing those kids had. And just the struggle to impress his father. I tell you what, both Michelle and I, my wife Michelle, we shed a tear or two when he won that first Iditarod, and there walked in Dick Mackey into the Mushers Hall there in Nome. That was a pretty powerful moment, wasn't it?
It really was. And there's a lot of great stuff about the Iditarod, and there's a lot of wonderful wonderful scenes showing him and his dogs and him out on the trail. But the most amazing and surprising thing for me was how revealing he was and how completely honest and unabashed he was about his relationship with his dad. With both of his parents, actually. And it surprised me how honest and vulnerable that was. And it was just a really wonderful and amazing thing to see. I saw a screening of the documentary that Lance spoke at, and one of the things that he said is that he, after he had seen the final version of the movie, he had to call his dad and sort of warn him that there was some stuff that maybe didn't cast either of them in a particularly good light. He said at the screening that although he and his father have had a very difficult relationship over the years, that they are getting along very well now, which makes me very happy.
You know, as a filmmaker yourself, the folks in the movie have really no idea what's going to go into the movie when they're filming. You know, they may get hour upon hour upon hour, hundreds of hours of footage, but you don't quite know what's going into the film until the editing's done. Isn't that right?
Yeah. I mean, for some people will go into documentaries and they'll have an idea of what they want to get, and then they'll just try to get those things, and they'll basically have a list of, I need this thing to indicate this, and I need these things to indicate these other things. But with documentaries that I think really are more powerful and work better, there's a certain amount of serendipity, and there's a certain amount of getting yourself to a place where things are going to happen, and then just seeing what you can get. And sometimes you don't know quite what you've got until you come back and you start putting it all together. I am with you. I think this is a phenomenal achievement and just a really, really great documentary, and very highly recommend it to anyone who's a fan of Iditarod or a fan of dog mushing.
Check it out on Netflix, The Great Alone, the Lance Mackey documentary. It's been out, I don't know, a year or so now on the circuit, and then, of course, just came out last month there on Netflix. So, relatively quickly, Alex, I know we're 15 minutes over, way longer than we wanted to, but there's always important stuff to talk about on our biweekly show. What recommendation or recommendations do you have for us this episode?
Okay, I have a novel that is relatively new. It's called Before the Fall, and it was written by Noah Hawley, who is a TV writer and producer, and he is the guy who is the showrunner for the show Fargo. And it is a story with wonderful characters. It's a bit of a thriller. There is a plane crash at the beginning, and then you go through each of the characters who are involved, who were on the plane or were involved with people on the plane, and go through and at the very end, it reveals exactly what happened and why. And it's filled with twists and turns, and it's very the characters are phenomenal, and it's just a really, really great and quick read. So that's Before the
Excellent.
Fall by Noah Hawley. And other
Excellent.
Than that, I have been catching up on Orphan Black, which is a BBC show that I really love, where this woman plays, I believe it's six or seven different clones. So she's basically playing six or seven different characters who all look a little bit alike but act completely differently. And that is, I believe it's in its fourth season now, and I have been catching up on watching old episodes of that and getting to the new episodes.
Is that available on Netflix or one of the other streaming services?
I believe the previous seasons are on Netflix, and then it's on BBC America, so some cable companies will have it on demand. and called Orphan Black. So very highly recommended.
Very good. All right, Alex, thank you very much for joining us today. Very quickly, find us over on iTunes. DogWorks Radio is our network. We have several shows that air every month, The Gypsy Musher with Hugh Neff, The Side Vibe with my friend Dorothy Wills Raftery, of course, Mushing Radio with Alex and I, and on occasion, DogWorks Radio, the flagship show of the network, will air a dog training topic. Those are tough to do. I just don't have a lot of time to research new dog training topics, even though it's what I do for a living. Maybe I need to do a couple more of those shows. So, Alex, we'll talk again in a couple of weeks. Have a great one, and we'll see you soon, all right?
Okay. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, this is Robert Forto. See you guys next time. Goodbye.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.